Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
This week, Congress approved the President's request for additional powers during this time of war that appears to be headed into a war without end, for extending his right to abandon the protections afforded every American citizen. To many, it is changing forever the nature of democracy. But it has all been done before. In a moment, we visit the legacy of Manzanar, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. In a remote area of California, backdropped by the Sierra Nevada mountains, with vast panoramic vistas and a valley rich with productive apple orchards, war, World War II to be specific, made a stand right in the middle of this vast, serene place. Manzanar is a name many would like to forget. Manzanar is now part of our national park system. To tell us more about this historic site is Frank Hayes, superintendent of the Manzanar Historic National Historic Site. It's quite a story and one which has very specific relevance to our world today. Frank, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. And you?
Doing great, thanks.
Frank, give us a picture of Manzanar when a world war changed forever this peaceful valley.
Well, in 1942, February 19th, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which put into motion the evacuation or removal or of Japanese Americans from what were called exclusion zones from the west coast of Washington, Oregon, and California to inland, one of 10 inland war relocation centers. Manzanar was one of those war relocation centers. It was opened in April of 1942, and its depopulation, there was over 10,000 Japanese Americans interned in the camp within less than a square mile, about 550 acres. And the war relocation center was made up of 36 blocks, each block having 14 tar paper barracks, a mess hall, a latrine, two latrine buildings, a men's and a woman's latrine building, and then some utility rooms. And each apartment barrack was split up into four separate apartments. The barracks were 20 foot by 100 feet long, and so each apartment was 20 by 25 feet. And right at the beginning when the camp was opened, up to eight people occupied each of the four apartments within the barracks. And it could have been eight people from a single family or from different families. So it was definitely something, you know, privacy issues and so forth that people were having to deal with right when they first moved into camp.
I'm just curious, to what degree were people able to bring in their personal belongings? And make it
well, they were allowed two trunkfuls, basically, of their personal belongings. So, you know, there was 120,000 Japanese Americans impacted by the internment, and most of them either sold their belongings at cut-rate prices or, you know, lost them during the war. There were some that had friends or churches that stepped up and took care of their belongings, their homes, or their farms while the Japanese Americans were interned, but the vast majority lost most of everything. And so, like I said, they could bring two trunks, essentially per person, into camp of their belongings. And, you know, it was hard for folks to know what to bring because they didn't know what to expect. You know, many of them were leaving kind of moderate, temperate climates were pretty harsh environments at one of the 10 camps, and so it was, you know, it was hard for them to pack and decide what to carry, and they didn't know how long they were going for or, you know, what kind of conditions they were going to face. So
I suppose the furniture was pretty much standard issue throughout the site.
Pardon?
I suppose that the furniture was this kind of standard issue throughout the...
Yeah, it was actually pretty spartan, and in fact, you know, a lot of the folks, and one of the most compelling pieces, I think, in our exhibits are some beautiful pieces of furniture, dresser drawers that were made out of fruit crates from one of the camps. So, you know, the folks were, the attorneys were gathering up spare wood, thrown away wood, wherever they could, and were fashioning furniture out of that spare parts wherever they could. And some of it, you know, it's just this furniture we have on display is just absolutely beautiful, and it's created out of fruit crates.
Very interesting. By the way, people can see elements of the site as well as a map on the website where you can click on that and it will enlarge. So how long were people there?
They were up here for up to 3 years. In February 1943, the government, realizing some of the constitutional issues that they were facing and so forth, opened up the camps for people to relocate out of into the outside of the exclusion zone, so they had to have a job and guarantee that there weren't going to be any problems, and then have somebody sponsor them in the interior. Now, there were some people who had contacts and were able to do that, but quite a number were in camp for the entire 3 years. They closed. NASDAQ closed finally in November of 1945.
Now, by the way, is it proper to refer to internment and relocation kind of in the same breath?
Well, you know, that's a terminology of how you describe the camps is something we, I don't say we would struggle with, but we definitely thought carefully about in dialogue with a variety of people and thought the best approach was to explain the wide breadth of terminology that's been used to describe the war relocation centers. We generally rely on the historic names, but we show and interpret the sites for everything they were called. Some folks here in the valley and other places refer to them as, you know, historically as Jap camp, and then it's all the way through to being called concentration camps. President Roosevelt called them concentration camps, and many in the Japanese American community prefer that they're called concentration camps today.
Well, let's
so we try to interpret that breadth of terminology and then allow visitors, invite visitors to figure out, you know, what that particular visitor thinks about the terminology and what happened out at the tent camps.
So the camp was eventually over, and then what happened, and that relates to the question of what's there now today. So tell us that little story.
Well, there was, the Manzar was located on City of Los Angeles land. The City of L.A. has brought up much of the Owens Valley for to preserve water rights. They export a lot of the Owens Valley water that comes out of Sierra Nevada down to Los Angeles. And so much of the valley floor is owned by Los Angeles, and the site where Manzanar is located was, during the war, World War II, owned by Los Angeles. And up until 1997, when the site was transferred over, the Park Service was still owned by the City of Los Angeles. And so it had pretty much remained untouched. Now, all the buildings, there were 850 buildings that were used during the years the War Relocation Center was open. And all but three of those buildings were removed. But there's still ample evidence of the camps, the road networks, the foundations, these incredibly beautiful rock gardens that the Japanese Americans constructed. Well, they were here, are present throughout the site, and those are all readily visible. And there's also a kind of an iconic cemetery monument out on the west side of the site that, you know, there was an actual working cemetery, and there's actually still folks interred there.
Now, just recently, you had your grand opening for the Interpretive Center, and that's kind of an interesting story right there in terms of where the Interpretive Center is. It's giant. Tell us about that. We've got about a minute and a half left, so we'll move on rather quickly.
Okay, great. Well, the Interpretive Center was an auditorium building constructed by the internees in 1944. That building was occupied by the Inyo County for 50 years or more as their maintenance facility. The Park Service acquired that building and adaptively restored it into our interpretive center. So now we have 8,000 square feet of exhibits about the internment camps. We have two small movie theaters that shows a 20-minute film we've produced about the internment. We've got a ranger information desk, a bookstore, and then our headquarters offices are all located right there in this interpretive center. So that's one of the three buildings that had remained from the camp period.
It looks like quite an interesting place, although I'm sure it has many mixed memories. Let's do two things. Let's tell people how they can go to your site literally and virtually.
All right, great. Well, we'll start out virtually. Go to NPS, like nationalparkservice.gov, /mans, M-A-N-Z, and make sure you click on the in-depth section because there's many illustrations of the camp and exhibits and so forth, much more in-depth information than you find on many other national park web pages. We're quite proud of it. And then to visit the site personally, we're open 8:35 daily, Monday through Sunday, so 7 days a week, except for Christmas. And you can reach it by driving 4 hours north of Los Angeles on Highway 395. We're between the small communities of Lone Pine, California, and Independence, California, near the shadows of Mount Whitney.
Frank, thanks for being with us. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again on the Wild Side News.